If you've bought fresh tomatoes in the winter, there's a good chance that they were picked by a slave laborer. Human trafficking has long supplied Florida, the tomato capital of America, with a steady stream of cheap and free migrant labor, and that's not the only problem with the U.S. tomato industry. The quality of grocery store tomatoes has also steadily declined in recent years. James Beard Award-winning food journalist Barry Esterbrook was on our show in July to discuss his book, Tomatoland, How Modern Industrial Agriculture Destroyed Our Most Alluring Fruit, in which he investigates not only the working conditions of tomato farm laborers, but also why the $5 billion tomato industry is struggling to produce tomatoes with any real flavor. We got a lot of response to the segment from our listeners, and we're re-airing that conversation for you today. I start off by asking Barry Esterbrook, when you began investigating this story, weren't you mostly interested in finding out why tomatoes taste worse than they used to? Did you even know that slave labor is used in some tomato farming?
I was startled, and you're exactly right. I was down in Florida trying to, you know, basically answer what happened to the taste of the modern commercial tomato, and why is it so different from the stuff we can get from our gardens this time of year or from the farmer's market? And it turned out that while I was down there in 2008, there was this horrific, violent slavery case working its way through the courts. A family had kept a dozen or more men enslaved for more than 3 years.
When we say slave, do we mean that field hands work for nothing beyond food and room and board?
Well, let's put it this way. Being shackled at night in chains, being bought and sold, people being bought and sold like cattle, being forced to work, and if you work too slowly or you don't feel like working, being beaten. And if you try to get away, being severely beaten or even shot, and pay sometimes a few bucks, but nothing regular and nothing meaningful.
Is that an established practice in the larger tomato farming businesses?
Well, it's too much to say that it's an established practice, but the fact is that in the last 15 years, there have been 7 major slavery cases processed in the Florida tomato industry. And 1,200 people have been freed.
But I would assume that means that a lot of people are looking the other way. Otherwise, I mean, if it's as common as you suggest, it must be apparent that there are a lot more people who are enslaved.
Well, the U.S. attorney for that area, who's unfortunately become something of an expert in prosecuting slavery cases, claims that what we've seen is just the tip of a very, very, very ugly iceberg. It's hard to prosecute a slavery case. Most people, once they get free, they don't want to stick around for a trial. They want to get out of there.
A lot of we're talking about huge agribusinesses. And the higher-ups, do the higher-ups in these companies even know that this is going on?
Well, they certainly profess not to. And in fact, the Florida tomato industry, the higher-ups are separated from the goings-on in the fields because the whole system of labor is contracted out to labor contractors, they're called, or crew bosses, who do the day-to-day management of people actually working in the fields.
Now, I imagine that there are still people out there who are working under normal conditions. How many of the field hands get minimum wage?
Well, although the conditions are improving, the fact is you're very, very lucky to make minimum wage picking tomatoes. If you look at it over the course of a year, they make between $10,000 and $12,000, which is below minimum wage, because they don't work all day, every day. If it's raining, they're out of luck. If they get to the field and it's wet with dew, they sit around for 3 hours till it dries.
And they're paid for piecework, aren't they?
Well, they're paid per bucket of tomatoes. It's about the size of a bushel basket. And they get about 50 cents for a bucket of tomatoes that size, weighing 30 pounds. But supposedly, according to law, that has to equal out to at least the minimum wage. But again, if you're waiting beside the field and not allowed to go in while the vines ripen, you're not getting paid.
And are they hand-picking the tomatoes?
Yes.
So yeah. How long does it take to pick a bucket?
Well, a good picker will pick about a ton of tomatoes a day. So it looks, if you've ever seen a dog digging, that's how their hands are moving that fast, and then they lift these buckets over their shoulders and run them across the field to a truck.
And I'd imagine that the further they get into the field, the less they're getting paid because they have to travel further.
Exactly. And the crew bosses can play favorites very easily because the people working the rows closest to the truck can make considerably more than the people furthest away.
Did you speak to any of the field hands?
I did.
Where do most of them come from?
The vast majority of the people working in the Florida tomato industry now come from southern Mexican states or Guatemala, pretty much that region.
How do they wind up in Florida?
Well, they're 70% of the people working in the industry are undocumented immigrants, and they come up through a system of they're called coyotes, and they're you know, unofficial guides who charge them quite a bit of money to take them from their villages across the border and eventually to Florida.
With a promise of work?
Mm-hmm. A promise of work.
Because I always thought that the coyotes, usually it's just people come to the border, they pay to be brought across, and then they disperse and look for jobs.
Well, that certainly does happen. But in a lot of cases, the coyote is actually working unofficially for a crew boss. So he's going to the villages and saying, look, I got a guy up in the States who needs some workers. I can get you across for...
This is the same sort of thing that we're hearing about in places like Eastern Europe, where women are told that they can get jobs as waitresses or hostesses or whatever, and then wind up being forced into prostitution. And they're paying to be moved out of their home country into other places where they're going to be forced to work for nothing.
Right, and frequently they're charged an artificially high figure, so that it's debt peonage.
You have to pay it back.
It's old-fashioned owing you don't owe your soul, you owe your body to the company store. You can't get away from it.
You say that many of them are shackled. What are their living accommodations like?
Well, the shackled was in court papers. These were the slaves, a group of slaves that had gotten freed. But even people who are not enslaved live in some of the most horrific conditions I've seen anywhere in this country. Particularly in southwestern Florida, which is a key growing area, they live in these dilapidated 1950s trailers that are, you know, the sides are peeling up. 10 guys. In one trailer I visited, 10 guys were living in it. The 5 mattresses in each little tiny bedroom, 3 on the floor, 2 suspended from plywood, 1 little lavatory, not much bigger than one you'd get in an airplane. 10 guys coming in after working 10 or 12 hours in the fields. And they were charged $2,000 a month to live in this place, which is typical.
Well, in the days of slavery, if a slave escaped, he or she was tracked down. Does that sort of thing happen here?
It has happened. It's in the court records. It definitely has happened. Tracked down. In some cases, the people were brought back as examples, just virtually crippled. They were beaten so badly. In other cases, there's been bodies found floating in the canals and rivers.
But aren't there housing regulations in Florida that would make those kinds of living conditions illegal?
Well, there's a couple of problems. One is that a lot of these houses are in not in municipal areas. They're like in rural areas that don't have zoning laws. And a lot of them are grandfathered in. They've been there so long that they're immune from new housing regulations. And the second problem is if you close these places down, where would the people go?
And the local laws allow for this sort of thing in towns like Immokalee?
They certainly do. The one fairly large extended family owns many, many of these trailer camps. And whenever they're tried to be shut down, they sue. They sue the county. They sue whoever tries to do it. And so far have been successful.
Hey, you argue that a catch-22 exists in a town like Immokalee that slows the progress of better housing for workers.
Well, think of it. You've got this old ratty trailer, probably 10 of them sitting on a city lot, and you're getting $2,000 a month for each one. that little crummy lot and those falling apart trailers are worth millions as a real estate investment. And so people, if they try to buy the property, they're going to have to pay millions they can't afford. And the landlords will hold on till the bitter end.
You also write that although as many cases of human trafficking occur in the United States as murders do, only 1% of the human trafficking cases are ever resolved. Why is the number so low?
Well, the U.S. attorney in the Southern District of Florida explained that simply slavery is not a crime that reports itself.
Because some of these people are illegal immigrants,
they're afraid to tell anybody. They are illegal immigrants or undocumented. They're in a foreign country. They may come from a part of the world where the police are just thugs in uniform. When they get free, all they want to do is hightail it and get as far away as fast as they can, and that's what happens.
Well, if somebody, one of these people, went to the law and said, I've been enslaved, isn't it likely that person would be deported?
Well, in fact, if that's true and the authorities believe that that was indeed the case, there's a visa that you can get if you promise to stay and testify. You can get a visa that's good for the time you're in court and also entitles you to get legal status afterwards.
So why aren't more people taking advantage of that?
Well, because they're threatened. I mean, in some cases, these slave owners have relatives back in the people's hometowns. And basically, there was one case where a guy escaped, and the slave owner simply called his cousin in the hometown of the guy and said, if we don't get this guy back, we're going to kill his mother and father. And so the guy came back on his own.
Have workers been able to unionize or work together to demand better working conditions?
There is a grassroots labor rights group in Immokalee, Florida, which is a city in the southwestern part of the state, a big agricultural center, called the Coalition of Immokalee Workers, that came together in the early 90s as kind of a ragtag crew and has gathered more momentum over the years and has, in fact, affected some major changes in the last year in the way tomatoes are harvested and how people are paid.
Well, they attempted to organize a boycott of fast food restaurants that use these tomatoes. Many of the restaurants eventually did give in, but Burger King held out for a long time. Why? What was their justification?
Well, you know, it's Burger King just said simply that we don't get involved in labor disputes between people who supply us and their workers, and sort of tried to brush it off. And if it was in fact brought in when the coalition discovered that one of its executives was using his daughter's internet alias to write scathing comments to newspapers about the Coalition of Immokalee Workers, and that sort of embarrassed Burger King as much as anything into coming aboard this agreement, which gives the workers a penny more a pound, which is the difference between $50 a day and $80, the difference between not being able to feed your family in a crummy but livable wage, and other basic labor rights grievance procedures, procedures to help prevent slavery and sexual abuse in the fields.
There's also been an attempt at popular education, hasn't there been?
Right. The coalition uses that it's common in South America you're dealing with people who are illiterate. Often they don't these workers' first language isn't Spanish. It's a Native American language, and they're awkward in Spanish. They speak sort of high school Spanish, if that.
So they're Mayan or
they're indigenous people from, and so the education populaire is a way of showing the workers how they're being exploited. I mean, how do you explain to somebody who lived in a little village in Mexico what a multi-billion-dollar company was? You know, they wouldn't have concept of what a $1,000 company was.
Well, you started investigating this in 2008. Have these campaigns had much impact in the 3 years since?
They have. They've had tremendous impact. the first, they started working on the chain restaurants, as you said, and Taco Bell came aboard, and then McDonald's, and then Burger King, and then all the rest of them came aboard for this penny a pound extra. So that's great. And then the big food service companies that supply food to universities and museums, they came aboard.
A penny a pound isn't all that much, is it?
Well, it's the difference between $50.
No, I'm talking about for the person who's buying.
Yeah, exactly. Well, last time I checked...
They could have done 2 pennies a pound.
Last time I checked, a winter tomato in the supermarket here was $1.99, a winter Florida tomato.
My guest is Barry Estabrook. His book, Tomatoland, How Modern Industrial Agriculture Destroyed Our Most Alluring Fruit. So let's get to this other issue, the thing that originally got you interested in this. Why are tomatoes from the grocery store less flavorful than they were in the past?
Well, there's a simple reason for that. For the past 50 or so years, commercial plant breeders who breed the seeds that tomato farmers use have looked for one thing and one thing only, and that's yield. They want plants that yield lots of big tomatoes.
Let's return to this after we take a short break, okay? Barry Estabrook, his book, Tomatoland, which is published by Andrews McMeel. We're back with a conversation I had back in July with Barry Estabrook, Estabrook. He was on our show to discuss his latest book, Tomatoland, How Modern Industrial Agriculture Destroyed Our Most Alluring Fruit. I began the second half of the interview by returning to our conversation about why tomatoes have less flavor than they used to. And I asked Barry Estabrook, to some degree, isn't it all a matter of genetics?
Exactly. What happened was in the process of breeding for yield, as one farmer said, I don't get paid a cent for flavor. I get paid per pound. They essentially lost the genes that give tomatoes the flavor. It's very difficult to breed for tomato flavor, and if you're not getting paid for it, you're not going to bother.
Well, they may not be as tasty as they used to be, but are they less nutritious?
It's amazing. The tomato today, the supermarket tomato today, according to the United States Department of Agriculture, contains 30% less vitamin C per gram, 30% less calcium, less niacin, all the vitamins and minerals across the board. The modern tomato has less than a tomato you could pick up in the 1960s.
Well, to some degree, it's because, as people have said for quite a while now, they're often picked when they're still unripe.
They're picked when they're bright green. In Florida tomato fields, any indication of color, they're rejected and sold locally to local markets. But they're bright green. They try to pick them when they're at a stage called mature green, but you and I would say that's an unripe tomato.
They also want tomatoes that all look the same. Standardization is really important.
There's an organization in Florida called the Florida Tomato Committee that dictates every single dimension, shape of a slicing tomato shipped out of the state in the wintertime.
So when you go to a farmer's market, you'll often find these heirloom tomatoes that look ugly, that have little black cuts in them. They taste great. Those would not be allowed.
They would be rejected out of hand. In fact, they have been. There have been people try to introduce heirloom-type tomatoes to Florida and met with great difficulty.
Why does the Florida Tomato Growers Exchange impose these rules?
It's one of these things that started out as a good idea. It started out by Franklin Roosevelt during the New Deal, where he essentially gave certain farm groups exemption from the Competition Act. And in that time, there were 1,000 little tiny growers in Florida, and some of them were sloppy and careless, and some were good, and they banded together to standardize so that a Florida tomato would all, meet a standard set of criteria.
Are they all pretty much the same species?
There's one variety that predominates, but they do grow several different varieties. They're the same species. All tomatoes are the same species.
There are no wild tomatoes growing in Florida, are there?
They don't grow there naturally. There's still plenty of wild tomatoes growing in western South America along the desert coasts there between Ecuador and Chile.
But in the case of Florida, we are talking about huge agribusinesses. Aren't there some very good tomatoes that come out of Florida? In the cold months, some of the better restaurants buy tomatoes from suppliers. The one that I've heard of is Lucky Lee.
There are some producers in certain areas who are breaking the mold, yes. There's a large organic farmer, Lady Moon Farms, mm-hmm. which picks its tomatoes ripe, and there are other localized areas around Ruskin and south of Miami and Redlands where people are trying to break this mold by creating a better-tasting tomato.
And then they ship the tomatoes up right away so that they don't have to pick them green.
Right.
The others are shipped on a slower process, and we always heard about this gas that ripens them.
Yeah, they're picked green, and they're boxed in 25-pound boxes, and the boxes are stacked on pallets in warehouses, and they close the door and flood the warehouses with ethylene gas, and that... It's a gas the tomato plant will naturally produce when its fruit is ripe to tell it to turn color. But even if it's not ripe and it's exposed to that gas, a tomato will still obligingly turn red, even though it'll have no other qualities of ripeness, including flavor.
Is there a historical reason that so many tomatoes are grown in Florida?
Well, the reason is simply closeness to markets. At a time of year when it's cold up here and cold in the Midwest, Florida's within a two-day truck drive, and that's the only reason tomatoes grow there.
But you also say that Florida tomatoes are grown in sand.
Yeah.
Isn't there soil in Florida?
There's not where the tomatoes are growing. So there's a small area in southern Florida where tomatoes are growing in a coral gravel. But for most of the state, it's sand. It's not sandy loam or sandy soil. It's the same stuff you've got on Daytona Beach and about as nutritious.
Because plants obviously get all sorts of nutritional things from the soil. They're getting nothing from the sand?
No, they may as well be growing in a sterile medium. Everything that they get has to be put in most cases, in the form of artificial fertilizer before the plants are planted.
You note that tomatoes are responsible for 17% of all produce-related foodborne illnesses in this country, more than any other vegetable. Why tomatoes?
There's no answer to that. I've tried to find out why, because it seems counterintuitive. You wonder how this red thing that seems pretty solid can get... But there are ways.
And standardized in this case. Right. We've been complaining about the standardization, but that would suggest that they would all be pretty much the same.
Well, you know, they call that thing at the top that looks like a belly button a stem scar. If water comes in contact with that, that's got bacteria in it, it can actually get into the fruit. There's some research that shows that if there's stagnant water around the plants, they can absorb bacteria from that, which finds its way into fruit. And then, of course, there's the superficial bacteria contamination just from being handled.
At this time of year, there are a lot of locally grown tomatoes available in our markets and in the green markets, the farmers' markets. Are Florida-grown tomatoes still what we're seeing most in our supermarkets?
No. Florida will start producing tomatoes around Christmas time and go through May or June. Right now, the tomato fields in Florida are all fallow and dead and waiting. So the things in supermarkets now, a lot of them are hothouse tomatoes, and the growers are probably growing them in Virginia, New Jersey, as the summer progresses.
Isn't Mexico also a major source of tomatoes in the United States?
It's a major source, and it's growing. It's a big competitor with Florida tomato producers.
How do they compare in quality?
You wouldn't know the difference in taste. They're still the same bland, same appearance. They're basically what both countries have done is made of this just a simple commodity, a red thing without much else going for it.
We've talked about the slavery aspect of working the tomato fields, but what about pesticides and chemicals being used there? Are the workers protected?
Sadly, no. A Florida tomato farmer can use 110 different pesticides, fumigants, herbicides on his plants in the course of a single growing season, including some of the very most toxic ones there are.
You mentioned methylbromide.
Right. It's got a skull and crossbones on the container, and that's for a reason. And unfortunately, even though laws supposedly prevent it, all too often workers are directly sprayed. I talked to probably 36 workers, and when I asked them, they all said, "Every day, man. You know, they don't care. We try to run out of the way." So it's just horrific. And you know, like I say, these are the most toxic pesticides in agribusiness's arsenal.
And haven't the children of these migrant workers been directly affected?
There was a very sad case a few years ago, where three expectant mothers living, they were neighbors in a little labor camp, and they were all expecting babies around the same time. They all worked for the same tomato company. They were all sprayed throughout their pregnancies, and they all gave birth to horribly deformed children.
And many of the kids of these migrant workers are picking themselves. I understand that the United States is one of the leading countries in the world employing child labor, and it's for things like tomato picking.
Well, there's a different set of labor of child labor laws for agricultural workers, in fact. So it's written right into the law that, you know, you can work in the fields at a younger age than you can work in a grocery store.
Is there any way of knowing whether we're getting a good tomato or a bad tomato?
Well,
we have 10 seconds. I can't ask that anymore. Anyway, Barry Esterbrook's book, Tomato Land, How Modern Industrial Agriculture Destroyed Our Most Alluring Fruit, is published by Andrews McMeel. Thank you so much.
Thank you.